Chapter 16, Day 266. Theda Seafront, 06-02. Viltry's first glimpse of Theda City was from the cab of a Munitorum fleet transport in the small hours of the night. It was the first time he'd set eyes on it since the morning of the 259th, when he'd taken G for Greta aloft on her final flight. Things had changed. In the dark, from many kilometers distant, the city itself was invisible because of blackout regulations, but the shape of it was defined against the sky by the ruddy glow of firestorms throbbing in its heart.
"Holy throne," he'd breathed.
"Told you it was bad," the driver had said.
Viltry had made the journey along the coast overnight, begging lifts from a series of transport drivers. There was activity all along the seaboard, part of the frenzy of evacuation. Munitorum transit fleets were pouring out of Theda and the surrounding towns, laden with materiel and personnel for the evacuation ports, and then streaming back to depot, empty for another run. The vast night sky was a maelstrom of tracer, flak bursts, and burner trails. At Medenta, trying to find a ride to hitch amongst the chaos of traffic in the town centre, Viltry had been about 300 metres from a bomb strike that had destroyed a templum, 9 habs, and a machine shop. Everywhere he went, he could hear the drone of the arch-enemy's engines in the sky. The cargo 10 drove into Theda's outskirts at first light, stopping at several Munitorum or Commissariat checkpoints. The streets were deserted, apart from other military traffic. The slowly rising light, pale and thin, revealed a dusty, smoky world. They passed row after row of bombed places. Fire control teams fought with blazing tenements and hab stacks gripped by swirling infernos. Some streets were closed. Medicaid shuttles, bells clattering, rushed by. Just after 5:30, they reached the old town area. Like everywhere else, it had taken a pasting. Viltry had a clawing, sick feeling in his chest.
"I'm due at the assembly yards in Danzerplatz," the driver said. "Any good to you?"
"No, just let me out here."
The driver pulled the truck up at a street corner.
"Thanks," Viltry said, climbing down.
"No problem. Good luck rejoining your unit. Shoot some of them bastards down for me."
"I'll try."
The driver nodded and then pulled the truck away. Viltry began to walk. His tattered flight jacket still had the emergency compass sewn into the cuff, so he followed the needle and went north. It took him about 30 minutes to skirt up through the ruins of the old town to the seafront. The air was cooler here, fresher, despite the cloying smoke that wrapped the whole city. He heard the strange yet familiar sound of rushing breakers, the clatter of pebbles. He smelled the sea. How ironic that a smell so recently new, so alien to his background, should now be so evocative. He wandered down the broad seafront road for a while, trying to get his bearings. He was sure he should be able to see the piers. Finally, almost by accident, he realized he was standing by the familiar entrance arch. There was the chalkboard, propped up against the ironwork gate. Palace refreshments, table service, sea views. Beyond the arch, there was nothing, except a tangled mess of black iron and charred wood sprawled out into the surging tide. The piers were gone, destroyed, all three of them. "I think it'd take a lot to bring the palace down," Becca Mayer had said. Oscar Viltry felt his legs go numb and weak. He leaned against the cast-iron railings and closed his weary eyes. Theda Old Town, 06:30. There'd been a plan. A trip down to the Hydra on Voldney, all of Umbra, and the Fittest too, to toast Ash on her way. Blanchard had sent a message, ordering cases of Joylick and the private hire of the main bar. But then the snap call had come in at 20:00, and they'd gone aloft into the night, into the mayhem of darkness and fire. By the time they'd returned, debriefed, showered and been stood down, Larice Ash had already packed her bags and departed to meet her report time. She'd left a note. "Good flying, Umbra. See you up there somewhere. Larice." There was an empty feeling in the billet, a dark mood, somehow worse than if they'd lost a comrade in action.
"We're going anyway," Blanchard said.
They'd reached the Hydra at 4:00 in the morning, just as the staff were hoping to close, and tried their level best to rouse a party mood. But it was like a wake. Blanchard said a few words about Ash, and they were good words too, but they'd have sounded better coming from Jagdeer. The crew of Umbra sat around, morose. The fitters, always up for a free drink, got drunk and loud, but kept themselves to themselves. Van Tol and Cordial left after an hour. Zemek, who had been discarded by Larice Ash as quickly as Markwell, got brutally intoxicated, and then violently ill. Ranfrey took pity on him, found a driver with a truck, and took him back to the base, which left Markwell, Del Roof, and Blanche.
"Not exactly what I'd planned,"
Blanche said. The three of them sat around a table, toying with shot glasses. On the other side of the bar, Rackley and the fitters were playing drinking games, roaring out with laughter and good humor. The red-eyed bar staff sat behind the counter, longing for them all to go home.
"We could join them,"
Del Ruth suggested, tipping her head in the direction of the fitters.
"And spoil their fun,"
Blanche said.
"Pilots need fitters and fitters need pilots, and there is a bond close to love between them, but socially, no. Different worlds, different classes. We go over there, try to join in. We'll be as welcome as a turd in a foot bath."
Aguila Del Ruth had been halfway through a sip and snorted with laughter, choking so hard Markwell had to slap her on the back. It was the best laugh they'd had all night.
"Thrones save me," Blanche sighed. "This is so not what I'd planned."
"Story of my life,"
muttered Markwell, pouring out another measure of joylick for each of them.
"What's this now?"
said Del Ruth.
"Self-directed misery too?"
Markwell shrugged.
"Do you know, I was top of my class at Hessenville."
"Weren't we all?"
said Del Ruth, raising her eyebrows at Blanche.
"No, not me," said Blanche, sadly, reaching for his drink. "I was bottom. Pilot cadet voted most likely to wash out. I failed every exercise. Not just failed, mind. Failed dismally. One day my instructor took me to one side, led me out to an obs deck overlooking the Scald. He pointed to it. He said, 'Millen, this is your birth world. Plenty of sky, not very much land. If you can't fly, boy, what the frig else do you think you're going to do? Swim for the Emperor?'"
Del Ruth snorted her drink again and started coughing.
"Damn you," she gagged, wiping her mouth on a napkin. "That's twice."
Blanche smiled.
"I was top of my class," Markwell said. "Accelerated program, right at the end of the Liberation War. I mean, I was good. I longed to fly combat, kill bats. But now I'm in it, in the combat zone. I screw up. I can't hit a thing. My birds break down on me. I get people hurt."
"That's one way of looking at it,"
Blanche said.
"There's another way?"
"Well, for a start, there's the matter of two fine kills. Besides that, you've saved my life in the air, and I can't speak for others. You survived an eject from a slain machine. Not many do that. And there's that heroic use of rocket drive to break out of a kill shot. That last thing alone, Vander, that's one for the archives. I don't know of anyone who's even tried that, let alone come back to talk about it. Seacan should have come to you, not Larice."
Markwell managed to smile. "Thanks," he said.
"I mean it."
"You're a very good exec, sir. Just what Jagdia expects. You say the right things and boost morale."
"Maybe,"
said Blanche.
"Personally, I think there's an upside to everything. You just have to see it. Say to yourself, is the glass half full or half empty?"
"They're shot glasses," said Del Ruth flatly, staring at her own. "They're either full or empty. Anything else and someone isn't trying."
"I'll drink to that,"
said Blanche, and reached for the bottle. The three of them left the Hydra at 6:20 in the morning, dim light filling the sky. The fitters were still carousing. Blanche led them to the nearest Munitorum depot, booked out three transports and drivers from the pool, and then returned to the Hydra to collect the reluctant ground crew. They drove out along the highway. It seemed otherwise deserted. The strip of road was littered with trash and discarded possessions. Some broken-down vehicles sat on the hard shoulder. Markwell was riding in the back of one of the trucks with Rackley and a group of the ground crew.
"You hear that?"
he said suddenly. Rackley turned and cocked his head, trying to hear above the noise of the truck engine.
"Fan drives. Lots of them."
"Another raid?"
asked one of the men.
"Doesn't sound like bombers,"
said Rackley.
"Heavier."
"Oh, shit! Look!"
Markwell cried, pointing to the southern sky. Massive, multi-vector dropships were sliding in across skies above the eastern suburbs. Thousands of dots were showering out of them, like wind-blown pollen. Stormtroopers, on jump packs. From the depths of the war-torn city behind them, sirens began to rise in a howl. The mass invasion had begun. Theta MAB South, 06:39. The flashes of the detonations were coming so fast, the early daylight appeared to be strobing. There was a gritty, sizzling noise from the continuous bombardment. How could the sky hold up so many aircraft? Darrow ran towards the operation center. Bombs were falling on the inner city, and several tormentors had swung over the field wide, loads gone, turning out over the sea. The airfield's defense batteries were hurling everything they had at the sky. Tracers spiked up and danced. Flak turned the air into a broiling mass of flame-lit smoke. Fighters were already lifting off the field, either to fight or flee. Darrow heard mounting engine roar from several Oneros and other mass lifters. Figures mobbed across the landscape. "Extraction!" Darrow yelled at a Navy officer. "Everything, now!" the man yelled back, still running. "We're pulling out now!" Darrow looked to his left in time to see the Apostles lift off. They'd been prepped for a first light call, and now they launched, climbing northeast in the turmoil of the air. Their cream paint jobs made them look like blades of ice in the firelit sky. A sonic boom split the air like the muzzle bang of an artillery piece. A hell talon streaked long and low over the field and left a crop of furious blasts in its wake. Two marauders were blown up on their hardstands. Darrow was one of the many who threw themselves flat as the talon thundered over. The wind was full of smoke and scraps of airborne ash. The furious metallic hammering of a nearby Hydra almost drowned out the background roar of explosions and jet engines. Darrow got up, started running again. Another aircraft went over, and he saw running personnel not 20 meters away from him thrown into the air by cannon fire. Then there was a tremendous vibrating roar and a prickling wash of heat as a laden Ornero took off and crawled past overhead. There was blood in Darrow's left eye. He'd caught a scratch in the left eyebrow, shrapnel probably, and blood was running down into his vision. He kept running. Another big transport took off, kicking up dust and grit. Darrow saw bodies on the ground, two Navy airmen and three ground crew. The force of the strafing fire that had claimed them had punctured the ground in a long, broken gouge, stripped most of their garments clean off, and left them lying in impossible, dislocated poses. Darrow glanced away. It was a hard thing to look at. People still ran past in all directions. Some were wounded and being helped by others. Two pilots staggered past, carrying a fitter upright between them. The fitter was making an odd, sobbing noise. His face was... Again, Darrow turned his eyes aside. Over on the hardstands, the latest enemy strafing run hit a Bowser, and a huge sheet of yellow flame splashed up into the air. On the northernmost pads, squadrons of Valkyrie carriers were warming up, their stern hatches open. Personnel streamed towards them from the base buildings. More planes launched, mainly Thunderbolts. One of them was hit by a Seeker rocket as it tried to lift, caught fire violently, and belly-flopped down into a loading bay, killing at least 20 ground crew. Darrow winced at the heat of the blasts. Then he saw Eads. Feeling with his cane, Eads was approaching the entrance of the operations building. Navy crew ran past him. A low-flying locust chewed a line of shots up into the side of operations, ripping out brick dust and pieces of tile and shutter. Protecting his face, Darrow ran towards Eads.
"Sir, is that you, Darrow?"
"Yes, sir. Come on, I'll get you onto an evacuation flight."
"I should go to operations. This attack needs proper..." "There's no point, sir,"
Darrow yelled above the concussive noise of the bombing.
"It's all gone. Everything's gone. The enemy is here, right at the gates. We're pulling out now."
A clutch of submunitions detonated 40 meters away, killing a dozen people. The pressure of the blast wave knocked Eads and Darrow flat. Scrambling up, Darrow fought to get Eads on his feet.
"Somebody help me,"
he cried at the figures running past. Most just ignored them. One went by, then stopped and ran back. It was Sculter. He helped Darrow lift Eads, and they started moving. Sculter yelled something about the blood pact over the din.
"What?"
said Darrow.
"They're saying blood pact are dropping into the suburbs. Ground forces, certainly."
"God Emperor protect us all,"
Eads said.
"Pardon me, sir," said Sculter, "but right now it feels like he's forgotten all about us."
Western District Theta, 06:40. The sirens woke Jagdia. Her room in the Hab Clinic was cold and damp. The window was rattling. She lay still for a moment, listening. Apart from the blare of the sirens outside, there was a murmur of disquiet in the old building. Her window rattled again. No, it was more than a rattle. The glass in the old wooden frame was vibrating. She got out of bed and went to look. Pulsing air pressure was making the glass shake. Jagdeer could see the blistering flashes of pattern bombing detonations underlighting the sky behind the immediate cityscape. Hundreds of smoke plumes were curling up into the murky dawn sky. In the clinic's courtyard below, staff members and patients were fleeing in droves. Jagdeer hurried across the room, got down on her knees beside her bed, and started to pull her clothes and effects out of the bedside locker. She found her boots, her flight coat. At that moment, a high-yield bomb landed on a building across the street, leveling it instantly. The entire clinic recoiled, as if its foundations were set on bedsprings. The window of Jagdeer's room blew in with the shockwave, ripping a blizzard of glass across the room. Jagdeer cried out involuntarily, hammered by the concussion, but her bed had shielded her from the shredding force of the glass. She crouched on the floorboards for a moment, tense with shock. She could smell smoke, physoline and heat scorching. She could hear the crash of rubble, the flames and the screaming coming from outside. Cursing her sling and the pain in her arm, Jagdeer pulled on the trousers of her flight suit, and then her boots. She had a vest top on, so she put the coat on over that. Good arm through the sleeve, slung arm under the coat. Then she went out into the hallway. Smoke was pouring into the clinic through the smashed windows on the courtyard side. She headed the other way. In the hall, she passed several patients and Medicaid staff lacerated by window glass. Most were alive, calling out, helpless. There was nothing she could do. The able-bodied staffers that she saw were simply running for the exits. Jagdeer found the stairs, then made her way out through the half of the building away from the blasted courtyard. Outside, she found herself in a back street. A few people hurried past her. Looking up, she could see strings of enemy bombers creeping overhead. She ran down the side street and halted at the corner where it joined a main road. Several commercial premises were on fire, and there was debris in the street. People rushed by, some crying and wailing in blind panic. A truck went by, then a car. She tried to wave them down, but they ignored her. In fact, the car almost hit her, so determined was the driver not to stop. Jagdeer yelled in frustration. She'd lost her bearings and didn't even know which way the base was from there. The only thing she did know for sure was that it was more than walking distance. But she didn't seem to have much choice. Theta MAB South, 0659. Darrow and Sculter hurried Eads onto the northern pads. Some of the Valkyries there had already started lifting clear, fully laden, probably overladen. One had been hit before takeoff and was burning furiously on the hardpan. Frantic personnel swarmed around the ramps and side doors of the others. The door gunner teams were trying to organize boarding, but the panic was such that fights were breaking out. Darrow looked around. He felt a knot of panic in his own gut. "Throne's sake," he said, aware of a tremulous quality in his voice that he couldn't help. "There won't be enough places."
"We'll try there," Sculter said, determinedly holding his nerves together.
On the far north edge of the pad area, almost by the field's blast fences, three old bulk transport lifters were warming up. The machines were a good distance away from where they stood, but it seemed most of the evacuees wanted a place on one of the faster, better armored Valkyries. The trio started across the pads towards the transporters. Other individuals, unable to get aboard a combat carrier or unwilling to endure the fight that would entail, began to break off from the clamoring groups around the Valkyries and head the same way too. Still moving, Darrow looked round sharply at the sound of small arms fire. Someone had snapped and drawn a handgun, trying to shoot his way onto a Valkyrie. In response, the door crew slammed the hatches shut and the carrier lifted off, scattering the crowd that had been trying to get on it. Denied their chance of escape, the mob turned on the man who'd fired the gun. The Valkyrie went over them, and then, to Darrow's amazement, came back in to land ahead of them. The door gunners opened the ramp again and started to wave at them. The machine's crew had clearly not been able to stomach the idea of leaving Theda empty when lives were wasting. Darrow and Sculter ran Eads bodily towards the ramp, in under the tail booms and into the embrace of the gunners.
"Get in, inside, find a space and a handhold."
The compartment was dark, a hot metal box. As they got Eads into a scissor seat, the door crew brought aboard several more stragglers. A buzzer sounded. The ramp began to retract again, and the engine noise rose to a scream. With a lurch, they left the ground, nose down, and began to accelerate and climb. Theta MAB South, 0702. Before the trucks had even come to a halt, the last three pilots of Umbra Flight had jumped clear and started to run towards their hardstand shelters. The fitters followed them.
I need just 5 of you,
Rackley bellowed above the raging bombardment.
The rest, get going. Evac transport over there.
Rackley turned and kept running with the 5 men who'd volunteered. The others started sprinting towards the last 2 Oneros that were loading near the main drome hangar. The truck drivers ran with them. The whole airfield seemed to be on fire. There were bodies and shell holes everywhere, overturned vehicles, buckled munitions carts. Some hardstands were ablaze, and in some burned the wrecks of planes that had never made it up. 2 Lightnings launched and swept away north. Markwell fully expected to find Double Eagle in pieces. But it was intact, and so was Blanche's bird. Del Ruth's, however, had been caught by strafing fire. The engines and cockpit were just mangled ribbons of metal. All the other Umbra machines were gone. Cordial, Ranfrey, Zemek, and Van Tull must have made it out. Into the air, at least. 3 razors went over, low, drives shrieking. In the western sector of the airfield, Tormentors were drizzling submunitions on the machine shops. Rackley sent 2 of his men to ready Markwell's plane, and 2 to do the same for Blanche's.
Basic checks, clear them off, and then head for the transports, he emphasized.
With Del Ruth and the remaining fitter, Rackley ran across to the adjacent row of hardstand shelters. The Thunderbolt wing that had occupied this area, the 76th Fire Drakes, had already quit, but they'd left 2 of their mustard yellow bolts behind. Bodies on the ground nearby left little doubt that both pilots had been mown down, along with members of the ground crew, on the way to their machines. 1 of the abandoned bolts had tail and elevator damage, but the other seemed okay. Rackley started work getting Del Ruth airborne. Markwell dropped into his own cockpit and switched primary systems on with 1 hand as he wrestled to strap up his harness. 1 of the fitters rolled the primer cart close for connection as the other disengaged the fuel and data feed lines and then jumped up on the wing plates to pass Markwell his helmet. The primer fired and surged, and after a second, 99's mighty turbofans began to turn. Markwell leaned out.
Unhook the primer and get out of here,
he yelled at the fitters over the rising whine. Just go! They ducked out of view under the cowling. Markwell closed and locked his own lid, fastened his mask, and then did a last pre-flight overview of vitals. Pressure, coolant, fuel, electronics, air mix, ammunition. Green all round. The fitters reappeared and waved him double thumbs. He signaled back okay, and the 2 men turned and began to run. The last Markwell saw of them, they were crossing the asphalt apron towards the heavy lifters. Ducts angled to vertical. Markwell eased open the throttle and brought Double Eagle up and away from the ground. 2, this is 8. I'm going clear.
Copy that, 8. Just get out of here.
In the present circumstances, no pilot needed to be dawdling about on lift. Still low, he swung the nose and lit the burners as he wound the ducts round to level. Markwell's Thunderbolt crossed the blazing airfield at rooftop height, power building. He glimpsed bats crossing behind him, but he ignored them. No tone warnings. He turned into a wide climb north, and in 30 seconds was crossing the coastal ramparts and a long white seam of the shoreline strand. Sea was under him now.
2, this is 8. Are you clear?
Confirm that, 8. Coming up at your 5. Don't wait for me. Turn and punch it.
1,000 meters below, Blanche watched Markwell's bolt blasting eastwards. He waited, then banked firmly, turning back towards the field he had only just left.
4, where are you? Aggie, are you launching?
From his high vantage point, the true extent of the destruction was finally clear. Blanche could only half see the ruined airfield through the blanket of black smoke and the sudden blooms of white and yellow flame. Beyond it, Theder City was encased in a vast nimbus of smoke. The air to the south was crawling with formations of enemy planes, dots that caught the sunlight and twinkled against the dark clouds.
Aggie, where are you?
He made another pass over the MAB. Below, Blanche saw 2 fat Oneros plow up out of the boiling vapor and thunder away in a tight track eastwards. Then a smaller transport plane came up, but it seemed to be in trouble. His blood chilled as he saw a pair of locusts streak over it diagonally and turn it into a fireball.
2, 2, are you receiving? This is 4.
Go ahead, I hear you.
Coming up now.
Blanche banked again and saw the tiny cruciform shape of Del Ruth's yellow Thunderbolt as it emerged from the smoke line. It was rising cleanly. Instinctively, Blanche turned his rudder and rolled down so that he was coming in behind her as she climbed. A Hell Talon, having just emptied its payload onto the field's main drome, swept out of the smoke and saw the flare of her burners. Opportunistic, It lined up immediately, using its pull-out momentum to propel it into a rear attack. It was 500 meters lower than Blanche and about the same distance ahead. Blanche hit the throttle, punched back into his seat, and dropped low, flicking on his targeters and activating his gun sight. He selected quad. He didn't want to risk hitting Del Ruth with lasfire if he missed. All Thunderbolts had their own feel, their own temperament. Del Ruth was still getting used to the individual character of her new machine, and as a result was flying slightly erratically. It saved her life. The Talon's first bursts, which looked like the sparks of a striking tinderbox from Blanche's position, went wide. Blanche tore down, leveled out, viffed slightly to adjust, and got the tone ping he'd been praying for. His thumb pressed hard. A cone of smoke gouted out around the nose of his bird as the quads chattered. A sudden, savage spray of fragments burst out of the Hell Talon. Blanche kept firing, smacking his shots into its midsection. Fire guttered out. Then the enemy machine split into two large sections, almost divided along its centerline. The shorn segments fluttered away below him.
"You're clear, Four, get moving," he boxed.
"You shouldn't have come back for me, Mill," her reply crackled. "You should already be gone."
Not true, he thought. Not true at all. As acting flight commander, it was his duty to make sure all his pilots got clear, even if it meant his own life. And the real tragedy was Umbra Flight had left one pilot behind, and there was now nothing any of them could do about it. Western District Theater, 0726. Jagdeer struggled along the transit way between Habstacks, yelling at every vehicle that rumbled by. Nothing stopped. There were people in the streets, and a penetrating, sickly air of distress, something which the word panic no longer did justice to. Every few seconds there was a flash or a rumble from the east, and the ground shook several times. One particularly large detonation away to the south was followed by a failure in power supply, betrayed only by the sudden cessation of the raid sirens. After that, in the strange quiet, there was just the distant booming, the whistle and crump of munitions, the drone of aviation engines. Once or twice, Jagdeer thought she heard distant gunfire, small arms. She put that down to her imagination. Her wound throbbed. She'd brought no meds with her, and she had managed to knock her sling half a dozen times during dashes for cover when bombers came over. Fatigue overcame her, quite suddenly, fatigue and a sense of hopelessness. She sat down on a curb and felt tears running down her cheeks. How weak was that? How bloody weak was that? A truck went past. She didn't even look up. She heard a screech of brakes. Jagdeer lifted her head. A Munitorum transporter, laden with packing cartons, had pulled to a halt 20 meters away, and the driver was dismounting. Jagdeer rose to her feet. It was the driver, the man with the burn-scarred face. What was his name? She couldn't remember. She wondered if he'd told her. She wondered if she'd ever bothered to ask.
"Commander Jagdeer, is that you?"
She nodded. He hurried over to her.
"I saw the jacket, recognized an aviator's uniform. God, Emperor, are you all right?"
"No," she said.
"You need a lift?"
"Of course I bloody do."
He helped her over to the cab and supported her as she climbed up. Then he ran around to the driver's side and got in.
"What are you doing here?"
he asked as he threw the truck into forward gear.
"I was in a HAB clinic, wounded on a sortie. I heard the raid began and I started to walk."
"What? To MAB South?"
She wiped her face.
"I'm not sure I know where I was going. Just trying to rejoin my unit."
"Of course. Wouldn't want another FTR,
he said. She hesitated.
"I never did thank you for your help that night."
"What help? I was out of line. Talking to the boy like that. You had every reason to be angry at me. Apart from that, what did I do? A bit of driving for you? That's all I'm good for these days. The Munitorum gives me instructions, and I do some driving for them."
"Even now? In the middle of this?"
"Even now. I am a servant of the throne, Commander. I do as I'm bid. My senior sent me to Cosco Administorum with orders to collect a bunch of Munitorum record files that someone somewhere didn't want falling into enemy hands."
Jagdeer shook her head.
"Record files? Not people. You could be carrying a couple of dozen human lives to safety in this truck."
"That had occurred to me, Commander. The Munitorum has curious priorities."
She looked round at him. He was concentrating on the road ahead. She realized for the first time that he had probably been a good-looking man before half his face had been melted.
"I don't even know your name," she said.
"Kaminsky," he replied. "August Kaminsky, Munitorum Transit Division, Vehicle 167.
You were air crew before that.
Combat pilot, Commonwealth Air Force, Wolf Cubs, and the like. 16 years. But that's ancient history.
Look, Kaminsky, she began, can you get me to the field? I know you have orders, but I really need to rejoin my command. He shrugged.
I don't know. Really, I don't. From here, it would be a long slog, especially given the circumstances.
Then I need to evac, at least. Anywhere closer?
Well, I've been told to report to an extraction center at Mandora Point on the North Shore. That's where these damn record files are supposed to be delivered. There should be mass barges there, maybe even lifters. Good enough?
Okay, that'll do. I just need to get out. Get out and clear, and then back in the game. He smiled. What? She asked.
I've been thinking that for months, he said.
They rode on for 15 minutes without talking. Kaminsky drove hard, almost recklessly, through the shattered streets. Several times, Jagdeer winced as he ran them into walls of smoke that washed across the roadway, without knowing what might be concealed by them. Twice, Kaminsky had to brake hard to avoid debris and slopes of rubble.
Theta's done for, he said at last.
Yes, I'm afraid it might be.
I guess these are the end times.
There's still a chance, he said. Swinging the wheel, he laughed at her.
I don't think so. Not now.
If a member of my flight spoke like that, I'd have them up on charges. There's always a chance. While we still breathe, by the grace of the Emperor, there's still a chance.
Then I count myself fortunate that I am not a member of your flight, mademoiselle. Enothis is my homeworld, and I gave everything I had to protect it. There comes a time when a person has to be pragmatic.
I fought for my homeworld, too. Now I'm here fighting for yours. Don't talk to me about effort. Don't talk to me about contribution. And as for being pragmatic, that's sometimes just another word for defeatist.
Well, screw you too, mademoiselle.
Kaminsky, look out! They'd just come through another drift of smoke. In the suddenly revealed road ahead, a group of figures, dressed in dark red uniforms, turned to face them. Jagdeer saw leering iron masks, bowl helmets, las rifles. Blood Pact, she blurted out. Turn round! Turn us around! Kaminsky was already hauling on the wheel. He swore loudly, fighting to avoid a full skid. The truck slewed around madly, stripping tread from its fat tires. It came side on to the arch-enemy troopers and stalled.
Kaminsky! Kaminsky! Jagdeer yelled.
Stop shouting at me! He yelled, gunning the starter.
The blood-packed drop troops began to fire at them, running forward. Las rounds smacked into the truck's side and one crazed the door window.
Kaminsky, for throne's sake!
Will you shut up, woman?
A las round went clean through the cab in front of their faces, shattering Kaminsky's side pane. The truck's engines burst back into life. Jagdeer was thrown back against the seat by the violent restart. Her left arm cracked against the door jamb, and she howled in pain. Kaminsky swung them round to the left, standing on the accelerator. The big truck sideswiped the burned-out shell of a car and slammed it out of the way. Then the blood-packed squad was behind them, and they were barreling away down a side street at nearly 60.
Are you hit?
He said.
No.
You cried out.
I'm not hit.
I'm sorry I shouted at you.
It doesn't matter.
Looks like we're not going that way, Kaminsky said.
Theda Old Town, 0743. All along the canal side, recent bombing had felled the ancient buildings and tenements, even the old Kazagat Bridge. But the Templum was miraculously unscathed. Coughing in the smoke and brick dust, Viltry hurried along the canal's bank and went down to the church door. He paused there and glanced up at the effigy of the God Emperor.
Remember me?
He asked. Viltry opened the door. It was almost disturbingly calm inside. The air was clear, though he could still smell the stink of smoke from the firebombing. The Templum was empty. The rows of pews, the alabaster columns, the faint residue of camphor and incense. He walked down the aisle, his boots clipping on the mosaic flooring. Saints and demons passed under his heels. The ministerium priests had long since fled. He came to a halt in front of the votary shrine. 3 candles burned there. Just 3.
God Emperor, he sighed. Oscar?
Oscar Viltry turned slowly. She had been sitting at the end of a pew row, hidden behind a column. He hadn't seen her. She was shivering in her thin coat. He took a step towards her, almost laughing out in strange delight.
What are you doing here?
He whispered.
Where else could I go?
Becca Mayer said.
How else would you know where to find me?
Northern Theda, 0823. 12. They tore out of the dying city and onto a coastal highland, where the Habs became infrequent and scattered. Jagdia glimpsed the sea beyond the headland.
Kaminsky, where are we going? She asked.
Not the field, that's for sure. Or the extraction, either. The bastards have the whole place locked down. I'm running on a hunch.
What sort of hunch?
The sort of hunch that will disappoint you if it doesn't work.
Kaminsky?
I think there comes a point, said Kaminsky, where the act of being pragmatic and the notion there's always still a chance become the same thing.
They went under a road bridge and then down a steep hill between rows of fish processing plants. Kaminsky suddenly turned right and drove the truck down an access way into a yard behind the manufacturers. Ahead of them stood a line of flakboard sheds facing the edge of the sea cliff. The sheds were painted green. The nearest had a large, shuttered door in the side of it. It was barred and locked.
Get out, Commander, he said.
She looked at him.
I mean it. Get out.
Jagdia climbed down from the cab and slammed the door. Kaminsky reversed and then drove the truck at the shutter. Jagdia winced at the impact. Trailing a fender, the truck reversed and drove in again.
Throne's sake, Kaminsky,
Jagdia cried out. A third battering run, and the shutter tore away at the sills, partially crunched out of its flakboard frame. Kaminsky got down out of his mashed truck.
Come on, he said.
Jagdia hurried over to him, and they bent in low to pass under the crumpled metal sheets of the door shutter. She found herself in a damp, echoing chamber. It smelled of rotting plyboard and salt water.
What the hell is this?
She asked.
Shut up and follow me, he said.
They edged through the gloom, Kaminsky leading. Jagdia saw fitter trolleys, compact bowsers, shelf racks of tools. There was a scent of promethium jelly in the air. Kaminsky opened another hatch and daylight spilled through.
This way,
he said. She followed him through the hatch and out onto a metal catwalk. They had entered a deep, flakboard-built hangar. The mouth of the bay, facing the sea, was open to the air. The floor cut away right down to the lip of the cliffs. Pale light flooded in through the opening. Jagdia could hear the breakers far away and below. Directly beneath them, in the shadows, two Commonwealth cyclones sat on steam catapult launch racks.
Coastal defense,
said Kaminsky, clattering down the metal staircase ahead of her.
They haven't been used in months, but I hope they were still here.
My lord,
gasped Jagdia, following him down. Kaminsky ran to the nearest machine, opened the cockpit door, and leaned in.
It's got electrics, but we'll need fuel. And a primer cart.
Jagdia came up behind him.
And then what? Fly one out of here.
He looked at her.
Exactly.
We can't,
Jagdia began.
Of course we can. You'll quickly get the hang of it. Simple, basic, that's all a cyclone is.
Kaminsky ran back along the machine's length and opened the tank cocks. He hefted a fueling line from a nearby bowser and connected it, fumbling slightly because of his prosthetic hand.
I can't fly that,
Jagdia said. Kaminsky started the bowser's pump motor. The fuel line wiggled and flexed as pressurized liquid surged through it.
I know you're not used to props, but she's real easy to handle, I promise,
he said, and hurried to the catapult stations at the back of the bay. Kaminsky threw some switches and got a generator firing. Then he pulled down a handle that started the catapult's steam engines, pumping up the piston track mechanism.
No, Kaminsky, Jagdia said.
She held up her slung arm.
Even a machine like this needs both hands. Throttle and stick. Remember that, airman? With the best will in the cosmos, I can't do it.
Kaminsky came to a halt.
I suppose you can't, he admitted.
He seemed deflated.
But you could, she said.
Me? I'm not rated airworthy.
Right now, this deep in the shit, I hardly think that's the point anymore. Let's be pragmatic, shall we? I'm a wing leader. I'll clear you as airworthy. I have the authority.
I'll need your help, he said, uncertainly.
Anything, she promised.
Keep an eye on the fuel dial.
Jagdia peered into the cockpit. The gauge was barely registering.
Slow, she called. How long?
Maybe 15 minutes to full tolerance. The pumps aren't famously efficient.
Jagdia did what all pilots have done since the beginning of aviation. She leaned over and flicked the glass dial with the fingers of her good hand. As with all pilots since the beginning of aviation, it made no difference. The steam pressure was rising. Between them, Jagdia and Kaminsky unhooked the support hawsers and suspension straps holding the cyclone in place.
Can you do a cockpit check?
Kaminsky asked.
You're more familiar with the layout.
Yeah, but there's something I need to do.
What?
The record files.
I think I should burn them, not just leave them here.
I'll do it, Jack Deere said. You finish the prep.
You sure?
Yes. How long have we got? Kaminsky checked his chronometer and then looked at the fuel gauge.
10 minutes.
I'll be five, she promised, and hurried towards the stairs. Kaminsky checked the catapult controls. They'd reached full pressure. He locked them off and tripped the lever that switched release control to the plane itself. Then he went to the Bowser. Its pump seemed to be ailing.
Come on, he hissed.
There wasn't time to find another and switch over. He clambered into the tiny cockpit. He'd done a few hundred hours on cyclones. It was oddly familiar. He tested the electrics, the glycol levels, the radiator levers. Then he checked the trim, leaning out of the cockpit to look backwards as he pitched and turned the stick and the rudder bar, watching the ailerons and the fin respond obediently.
Come on, Jagdeer,
he hissed. He looked at the fuel gauge. It was still so very low.
And come on, pump, he added.
In the upper part of the shed, Jagdeer fumbled around and filled a can with liquid promethium from one of the tank trolleys. It was hard to do, one-handed. The only light came in under the buckled shutter. Hefting the heavy can in her right hand, she ducked out into the open air. A few papers from the truck's load were fluttering free in the breeze. Jagdeer set the sloshing can up on the tailgate and then hauled herself up after it. She started to spill fuel onto the record boxes. It was a huge effort. She felt stupid and weak, having to set the can down so often to catch her breath. She heard an odd clattering noise. She resumed the work, dousing the entire pile. Then she jumped down, biting back the urge to cry out as her left arm jarred, and poured the last of the can into the truck's cab. That sound again. Not a clattering so much as a hammering, like steel pistons. She checked her chronometer. She'd already been 5 minutes. Then there was the matter of ignition. Jagdeer cursed herself for not thinking it through. She hurried back into the shed and started to search in the gloom. Toolboxes crashed over, drawers upturned. Something. Anything. Nothing. Panting, she stepped back. On the flakboard wall, a distress gun hung on a hook in a glass-fronted box. She picked up a 10-mil wrench and smashed the box off the wall. The distress gun was smooth and old, and it had started to rust. She snapped its barrel open and rummaged for a shell. That noise again. Clatter, clatter. Louder. She chambered the flare cartridge and closed the gun, then ducked back outside, aimed it at Kaminsky's truck and hesitated. Jagdeer took several long paces backwards and aimed again. She fired. The flare barked out, white hot, struck the side of the transport and ricocheted off up into the air where it spattered out streamers of green fire. Shit, she cried, and ran back into the shed to find another shell. The clattering noise was getting much louder. She found another flare and tucked a spare into her belt for good measure. Loading the distress gun, she ran outside again. The glow of the first flare was beginning to subside. She raised the gun again. To her right, at the mouth of the yard, a stork tank strode into view. It was painted bright red. Its striding metal limbs screwed it around, and it galloped in down the accessway, hunting for the source of the distress flare. Clatter, clatter, clatter went its feet. Behind it, blood-packed troopers ran in squads, weapons raised. Jagdeer fired the distress gun. The flare struck the record boxes, and in an instant, the entire vehicle was consumed in broiling fire. The heat blast knocked her over. Approaching, the stork tank started firing. Its heavy laser batteries recoiled and spat as they fired off volleys at the sheds. Jagdeer got up and ran towards the broken shutter. Inside, she kept running, colliding with a munitions cart and bruising her thigh. She yelped and pulled her head down as the ferocious shots of the stork tank punched through the flakboard wall behind her, splintering holes, letting in daylight. The air was full of swirling fibers and ash. She darted through the hatch, onto the catwalk, and down the stairs. "We have to go, now!" she was shouting.
"We're not fully fueled," Kaminsky yelled back from the open cockpit.
"Tough," she replied. She ran to the Bowser, deactivated the pump, and then struggled to disconnect the line from the cock.
"Just start her up," she screamed.
"I've not connected the primer," Kaminsky yelled back.
"No time! Just do it!"
Kaminsky threw the starter switches. The port engine growled, turned over, and then burst into raging life, kicking out blue smoke from its exhausts. The starboard engine cycled once, and then froze. Jagdeer clambered into the cockpit.
"Come on," she urged.
She could hear sustained lasfire above them.
"Trying,"
Kaminsky yelled over the single roaring engine. He switched off the starboard power plant, fluffed the throttle, and opened the choke.
We don't have much time, Jagdeer said. She closed her door and strapped up. Kaminsky turned the starboard engine over again. Dry fire. Again. Another cough. Again. This time it took. The prop howled into life. They both felt the airframe shaking. Okay, we're good, Jagdeer said. In the pilot's seat, Kaminsky seemed to freeze. You all right? Asked Jagdeer.
It's been a while. Didn't think I'd ever...
Kaminsky, will you shut up? We don't have time for the whole emotional thing now.
Right, of course.
Jagdeer threw some of the switches. Launcher at pressure. Current on. Armed.
Props at thrust, he said.
So, gun it, she replied with a smile. The hangar was clogged with dense smoke from the engines.
Jagdeer.
What?
Help me. Help me fit my hand on the stick.
Of course. Sorry.
She leaned over, closing his prosthetic hand around the control stick. His other hand was busy regulating the twin throttles.
Now I need you to hit the release, he said.
Okay. Ready?
No. So just do it,
said August Kaminsky.
Jagdeer hit the switch. The steam catapult engaged and flicked their cyclone out of the hangar and into the air with bone-jolting force. For a second, it began to drop, but Kaminsky nursed it and opened the throttles, lifting the delta wing up over the coast in a fast ascent. Jagdeer felt the steady purr of the props and smiled.
How's that feel, mister? She asked.
He was grinning,
like coming home. You torch my truck.
As promised.
They rose, banked around, and turned east.
Smooth, said Jagdeer.
Old habits, said Kaminsky.
He was grinning. They were rising to about 1,000 meters when the cyclone's antiquated detector systems emitted a warning beep.
Someone's got us, Jagdeer cried.
Where? I can't see him.
I don't know. What does the AllSpec say?
This bird isn't equipped with an AllSpec.
Oh, frigging great,
Jagdeer began craning her head around, turning as far as she could to scan out of the cyclone's bubble nose.
Locust, 11 o'clock, she yelled.
She got a brief glimpse of a bright red bat stooping in, cannons lit. Then Kaminsky turned the cyclone over in a suicidal bank.
Kaminsky! Kaminsky!
Will you shut up, woman? Will you ever shut up?
The sea rushed towards them. Kaminsky suddenly leaned on the throttles and rolled the cyclone.
Guns!
He stammered.
Negative
G was slamming at her.
What?
Guns, dammit, Jagdeer! I can't press the gun stud! I don't have a thumb! You'll have to do it!
She wrestled over, all her blood in her feet, fighting against the centrifugal force of the turning cyclone. She clamped her fist over his dead, prosthetic hand.
Tell me when!
Wait!
He feathered the cyclone up on a corkscrew, and then wafered it down violently as the locust slipped under them.
How the hell did you do that?
She yelled.
You just outdanced a vector thrust machine.
Shut the hell up and shoot! Kaminsky replied. Fire! Just fire! Fire!
He rolled the cyclone hard, and Jagdeer heard the sudden, sweet sound of target lock. She clamped her hands around the grip, around his plastic hand. Flame flash blitzed from the cyclone's gun ports. The locust banked out, rising hard. Then it ignited and blew apart.
Holy hell!
Jagdeer whooped.
Got him!
Hissed Kaminsky.
Yes, you did,
said Jagdeer, as Kaminsky banked the cyclone east.
Yes, you damn well did!